Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Sixth Division, the Honorable Justice Sanjay G. T. Taylor presiding, case number 22-0137, consolidated with 22-0138 and 22-0311. Marcelino Salinas versus Illinois Department of Employment Security.
Good afternoon. My name is Sanjay Taylor. I'm the presiding judge of the Sixth Division of the First District Appellate Court. I'm joined this afternoon by my colleagues, Justice Michael Hyman and Justice Celia Gamrath. If I can ask counsel to introduce themselves and tell us who they represent, and we'll start with the appellant, the state, Mr. Moe.
Certainly. Good afternoon, Your Honor. Assistant Attorney General Alex Moe, on behalf of the Department of Employment Security, its director, and the Board of Review in all three matters.
Thank you, Mr. Oh, good afternoon. And then Mr. Goodman.
Adam Goodman, Your Honors, on behalf of the three appellees, Messrs. Soni, Salinas, and Liputin, who are all former employees of Fresenius Kabi.
Okay. So, Mr. Mo, you will have 20 minutes to present your argument. That includes rebuttal. Would you like to reserve any of that 20 minutes for rebuttal?
If I may reserve 5, Your Honor.
And then, Mr. Goodman, you'll have 20 minutes to present your argument. Mr.
Thank
Mullen,
you.
I'll be with you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon again. Each plaintiff in these three consolidated cases was discharged for having falsified cleaning records at a pharmaceutical company. The Board of Review concluded that each had engaged in misconduct and was therefore ineligible for unemployment benefits. Under Section 602A of the Unemployment Insurance Act, misconduct is a three-part test. The first part asks whether the employee violated a reasonable rule. The third part asks whether that violation was repeated or caused harm. Neither of those elements is disputed on appeal. At issue today is the second part of misconduct, whether the plaintiff's violations were deliberate and willful. Here, the board's conclusions that those violations were deliberate and willful was not against the manifest weight of the evidence. This court should reverse the circuit court and instead affirm the board in each case.
Well, how do you explain that there are, I believe, like 30 cases that go the other way?
Certainly, Your Honor.
And these are identical cases. It's not, I mean, the briefs are pretty much identical. I mean, this is the same issue with all three cases before us, right?
Not exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
So each of these three cases proceeded separately before the department at its various different stages. And the evidence presented in each of these three cases was different. It is true that at the end of the day, all, I believe, 33 employees were discharged from the same employer for essentially the same reason. But in a deliberate and willful analysis, the board examines essentially the state of mind of each employee, what they knew and why they were doing it. That's a plaintiff-specific question, and that is one of the reasons why each of these cases needs to be adjudicated based on its own administrative record. So it's certainly true from a 10,000-foot view that there were 33 employees, and I don't know personally, I have no reason to doubt counsel's representation that the majority of the other cases came out differently before the board. But we simply don't know what was in those administrative records. We don't know why those decisions came out the way they did.
Well,
And
we
that's.
could quickly assume, Mr. Moe, can we, that the testimony in these cases was unrebutted, that these employees were simply following the direction, whether express or implied, of their employer to falsify these cleaning logs in order to maximize production. The employee's representative testified he never disputed that testimony. So it was undisputed that they were simply acting at the direction of their employer. So we can probably assume that that's why those folks were granted benefits in those 30 other cases. How do you, I mean, isn't this a case of clear error where the testimony is unrebutted?
Not exactly, Your Honor. And this question in particular is a good one because I think it gets to the distinctions between what was in the papers, including before this court, and what the actual evidence adduced at hearing in each of these three cases was. As an example, in the first of these three cases, Salinas, Mr. Salinas never testified that he was directed to falsify records. That testimony was simply not presented in the administrative record. There's an absence of evidence in that case. In direct contrast, the second of these three cases, the Licudine case, and apologies if I mispronounced that, I'm sure counsel will correct me if I did. In the second of these three cases, Mr. Licudine testified to a lot of things. He initially testified that he did the cleaning just at a different time. He then testified that he didn't do the cleaning and was told not to. And in that case, the employer's representative actually testified that when he had spoken to Mr. Licudine prior to the termination, Mr. Licudine had denied any wrongful conduct and instead stated that he cleaned the areas as directed, and he had always cleaned them, and he had never been instructed to lie or otherwise fabricate records. So I certainly understand that at the end of the day, these employees were working in the same facility, but the specific question of what these employees knew and what they were told to do is a fact-sensitive question based on what each employee was actually told. And on
didn't,
that point,
the referees in this didn't the referees in this case find that the employees received either express or implied direction to falsify the records? I mean, wasn't that the finding of the referee? And that notwithstanding that, they were still disqualified because they violated a known policy not to falsify records?
That was not the finding of the referee in the Salinas case. I believe it was not the finding in the Licudine case either, though Your Honor might have something before you that I don't. But in either event, the referee does conduct the hearing, and the referee is the one who actually speaks at hearing, but the decision under review is that of the board. And certainly with respect to the board's conclusions, in the Salinas case, the board did not reach such a factual conclusion. The board's factual conclusion was that Mr. Salinas had not been given direction to falsify records. And as I previously noted, there was never any testimony as to that point in that hearing. As to the second and third cases, the Licudine and the Sony cases, the board concluded that to whatever extent the supervisors may have been aware of the conduct of the employees, that that didn't absolve them of having violated the employer's policy in the first place. So
just to follow up on that point, in the Licudine case, the referee found that he was directed by his manager to not follow the company's procedure. That the referee found that the practice was condoned by supervisors, and that he was actually rebuffed when he attempted to speak with management about it. Isn't that the referee's finding?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. I would direct the courts to the board's conclusions in that case, though. This would be at page 221 of the Licudine record. The board concluded that Mr. Licudine never reported the this alleged direction that he had received to upper management or human resources, and separate and apart from that question, that to whatever extent the company or its supervisors had condoned the violation, that that did not absolve Mr. Licudine of the consequences of his own actions. On that point, I would note that to whatever extent plaintiffs did receive direct instructions to falsify cleaning records, that doesn't excuse misconduct. The Supreme Court has defined the state of mind necessary for a deliberate and willful violation, this is out of the Petrovic case, as a conscious act made in violation of the employer's rules when the employee knows that the action is against the rules. And respectfully, the employees here are undertaking fairly important work. They're compounding drugs at a pharmaceutical company. And so cleaning is not something that is secondary to the objective. I don't think it's a stretch of the imagination to see how, for example, cleaning a public restroom might not be a top priority, but this is a pharmaceutical company. And as was testified to by the employer's representative in both the Salinas and the Sony cases, production here was subject to FDA regulations, as it would need to be because these are pharmaceuticals. So if an employee in that position is directed to bypass safety protocols or to take action that they know may result in an unsafe product or that is against the rules in such a meaningful and important way, it's not reasonable for the employee to turn around, undertake the action, and essentially pass it off as direction of a supervisor.
Well, at least in the context of one of the claimants, he testified that he tried to, but was rebuffed. And another claimant testified that he was afraid he'd lose his job. I mean, these are all longtime employees, right? I mean, these aren't folks that are temp employees, have only been there a few months. I mean, some of these employees, one was like 16 years, I think the other was 12.
23. One was 23.
23 years.
Correct. I believe the shortest tenure was Mr. Sony with 8 years. He testified to in the hearing. Certainly, it's true that these employees have been there for a long time, but, and this is something that was also adduced at hearing at all three of them, they knew what the policy requirements were. They knew that their job obligated them to undertake cleaning during their shift of each of their stations. And cleaning here, I should also note, this is not just a matter of one person conducting a cleaning and calling it a day. The employer representative testified in all three of these cases that cleaning meant a deep clean, that there was one person to perform cleaning, a second person to verify it, that there were multiple people involved with the cleaning when it occurred, and that the cleaning itself was expected to take possibly 2 hours of the employee's entire shift. This is a substantial portion of the job requirement. And again, to the extent the employees were given direction to ignore this component of their job, that might be problematic for the employer, certainly, but the employees themselves should certainly know that what they are being asked to do is wrong.
And why
That
did any of the employees receive any warnings, or in their records were they criticized or punished, or was it recorded that they weren't doing their jobs? Anything like that?
I believe that in all three of the cases, the record reflects that no warnings were given under.
That's what I my that's I agree. And so there was nothing. These employees were excellent employees. Their records apparently were clean. They followed the rules. They did what they were supposed to do. It just seems like the company's pointing the finger at the employees for doing exactly what the employer wanted done.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the employees were not doing what they were supposed to do. All of them were aware of the policy, and all of them were aware that the policy required them to undertake cleaning in a certain way.
No, otherwise we wouldn't have this tremendous break between the cases, these three and the others. There's something going on here because 27 can't be right and three wrong. Either 27 are wrong and three are, they're all one way or the other. And you can say as you wish that it's on an individual basis. But when you look at the testimony in these cases and what is going on, if there was something wrong, there would have been something in their records. And so this was not something that just occurred at the end. It was a long-standing situation, as we know. And it seems like you're trying to blame the employees for doing something. If they didn't do it, they would have been fired or gotten something would have happened. These people needed these jobs.
Respectfully, Your Honor, these were at-will employees. They could have been terminated at any time, sort of regardless of their
That's
conduct.
right. That's right. That
And
makes it even more important that they follow what they had to do. 2 hours to clean. They didn't have time to do cleaning at 2 hours. Did any of the 30 ever testify that they took 2 hours to clean? Is there anything that you know of in any record that you see that somebody took 2 hours to clean? You said it took 2 hours according to the company.
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor, but I think more importantly for this court's decision today, the other 30 records that Your Honor referred to, those records are not before this court. They weren't before the board when it was making its factual findings either. And I certainly understand that these employees were terminated from the same employer, but at the end of the day, we get into questions of what each employee knew, what each employee was doing. And so to the extent that the board was drawing factual conclusions based on facts specific to each employee, it necessarily did so based on the record before. It is entirely
Let me ask
possible.
you, Mr. Mo, we're talking about these other cases, and one of the things that struck me as just really odd is that, the claimant's counsel here tried to submit the decisions of the other referees and the other cases to the board, and the board said no, because you didn't explain why you couldn't have submitted them before. Well, the reason why they couldn't have submitted them before is because they postdated the hearing. So that just made no sense to me. And it suggests that there may be an issue with how these cases are being decided by the board, because apparently none of the five members of the board picked up on this. And this then leads us to the second point in Mr. Goodman's brief, that, you know, where he argues that the process by which the board decides cases is broken.
Your Honor's question contains multitudes, so you'll forgive me if I sure have does. A multiple part answer. To take that last part first, Your Honor, the other decisions that were presented to the board following the hearing, those were not board decisions. Those were ALJ recommendations, and in one case, the decision of a claims adjudicator. So unless those decisions were then appealed to the board by the employer, those would not have been before the board in any event. The board would not have known about them.
Well, but certainly the board would have considered, hey, you know, look, all these other referees are finding that there was no misconduct, presumably because they were directed, you know, the employees were directed by their managers and supervisors to, you know, falsify the records. And so wouldn't that be something that any fact finder, any decision maker would want to know? I mean, I would certainly want to know it if I was deciding the case.
Entirely possible, Your Honor, but the problem
I mean, not
here,
just possible, not just possible, I mean, probable, right?
The problem
because
here-
These are folks, there's what, 30, I don't recall how many, 30, it was over 30 people that were fired on the same day for the same thing. These aren't all random firings. They're all fired for the same thing. And so, you know, any reasonable decision maker would want to understand what is going on here.
Your Honor, I see that I've overstayed my welcome, if I might answer Your Honor's
question.
We will
indulge you. We will indulge you.
Thank you. There's two answers there. The first is the procedural point that the board cited in each of its decisions. If one is presenting additional evidence to the board, it has to come with an explanation. That's both a procedural rule subject to review under the abuse of discretion standard, and it's just common sense. For example, if following this hearing, I were to file a brief in this case, the court would be entirely justified in striking it. The court would want to know why I was filing something and why I had taken it upon myself to submit additional evidence unsolicited. The lack of an explanation is the basis for why the board rejected that information. And I would direct the court to the Rogers case. It's cited in our papers with a very similar fact pattern in terms of the board's not having abused its discretion.
Are you saying that the board rejected the evidence because Mr. Goodman failed to explain its relevance?
That is the reasoning set forth in the board's decisions, Your Honor.
But isn't it self-evident where the referees are finding that the claimants did not engage in misconduct?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
It is not, Your Honor. And in the Rogers case, this court actually rejected that very argument. In that decision, the circuit court reversed the board's rejection of additional evidence, holding that in that case, and I quote, the record was replete with reasons, close quote, as to why the late submitted evidence was relevant. And the court said, quite simply, no explanation was provided to the board. And without an explanation, the board was entirely justified in not considering it.
Well, why would you do what we would do? If you did submit that additional brief afterwards and did not give us the reason, I would expect that we would ask this simple question is, why should we consider this brief? Give us the reasons. And if that's the rule, which you said it is the rule, then here's the rule. Not everybody knows all the rules. So we would say to you, give us a basis and we'll take it under consideration and then we'll decide. But to reject it out of hand is what happened here. So I think that we need to consider the way the board is operating. Here, they did not even ask. If that was their decision, they didn't have the reasons. And why don't you ask? Tell me why they couldn't ask.
They certainly could have, Your Honor. The point is simply that it's not an abuse of discretion for the board to enforce its own procedural rules.
Well, maybe
But
it is if they didn't ask, because this is a very, all these cases are very important, right, to both sides. And the board is supposed to be neutral. They want to hear, they want the evidence. They want to have the best arguments. They wouldn't want to leave something out that's important. And they don't know if it's important or not because there's no explanation. So isn't that abuse of discretion when you don't even consider the discretion because you don't even know the reasons? I mean, it was dismissed out of hand. Isn't that a problem? What would you think if we dismissed you out of hand and didn't give you a chance to explain yourself? I mean, I think we would. We always do.
Your Honor, I would certainly want to be heard, and I can certainly understand that interest. But at the end of the day, it was not an abuse of discretion for the board to stand on its rules. And in that respect, this case is on all fours with Rogers. But and even beyond that, the board did address the additional decisions that were presented to it. And here's a and this gets to a distinction that I think is very important, because in parts, the parties are talking past each other. I have no issue with the proposition that in a different case, a different hearing officer reviewed different facts and reached a different conclusion. That's fine. The problem occurs when plaintiffs are presenting these factual conclusions as a way to backdoor additional facts into the record of each of these three cases. To whatever extent there was additional testimony, additional documentation, or other information presented in any of the other 30 cases that plaintiffs wanted to present in each of these three records below, the time to do so was at the administrative hearing. They could have called these witnesses, they could have presented the evidence. What they can't do, and what no party in litigation can do, is to essentially have their trial, and then following the trial, present factual conclusions from a different case and ask the court, or in this case, the board, to accept those factual conclusions as facts for the purposes
of the case. They didn't ask that. Isn't it possible before us that if a decision comes down after you brief, after the trial or the matter that's under appeal, a case comes down, you bring it to our attention. That happens all the time. And you ask, will you take a, here's why you should take it, right? Usually the lawyer will say, here's why I think you should consider it. And we make a decision. Why doesn't that apply to this board?
The statutory answer, Your Honor, is that under the Unemployment Insurance Act, decisions even of the board are of no preclusive effect. There is no res judicata. There is no preclusion. There is no estoppel from any of these decisions.
That's but, understood. They're not precedent, but they may have a bearing. I mean, they could have had a bearing. We don't know because they didn't ask for the reasons. But that goes to the issue of the process here and whether they abused the discretion because they didn't even ask what the reasons were and why they should consider it, knowing just what you just said. I don't doubt what you said at all. But in light of that, that doesn't mean that these should be not considered at all. Maybe they should, maybe we shouldn't. We don't know.
Well, Your Honor, we have the benefit of the what if, because in each of these three decisions, the board below did go on to say, we're going to reject these additional claims decisions. But even if we were to consider them, they wouldn't change the outcome. So we do know what the board would have done if it had considered.
Mr. Moe, I'd like to ask you, so Mr. Goodman in his brief cites the article by Phil Kettner from the Daily South Town. And he says that the board staff attorneys overworked. They review their referee decisions and they draft decisions for the board, which the board then quote rubber stamps. In that article, a representative of the board is mentioned saying that individual board members or the entire board doesn't review each case, that only a single board member reviews the case, and then the decision of that single board member then is the decision of the entire board. Is that the process that's currently in place at the Board of Review?
I am not currently aware of whether the board's current process aligns with that described in the article, Your Honor. I
was that
also,
the process at the time of the article?
In 2015?
In 2015, yes.
I don't know, Your Honor. That's,
did it occur
that's
to you that perhaps you should ask your client if that's the process, given the fact that Mr. Goodman has raised what appears to be quite an important issue in how these decisions are made, because I'm not aware of there ever being a dissent on the Board of Review. And I think the board decides thousands, if not more than 10,000 cases a year. And common sense and experience suggests that if you get five people together, particularly from different classes, and present a set of facts to them, that on occasion they're going to disagree. So, what's the explanation for this?
I certainly appreciate Your Honor's concerns. I don't have an explanation to them before the court today. I do note, though, that to whatever extent these concerns have been adequately aired in the papers, these issues are not presented in the administrative record before this court. This is not a due process challenge. This is not a collateral attack on the administrative
Is
decision.
there anywhere in the regulations or on the IDS website where the board discloses to the public that, only a single member of the board decides each case and that the other members simply just follow along?
I don't know, Your Honor, and I also don't know whether that would be a true statement. I would also note
Oh,
that
let me ask
to
you this. Would it? I mean, you've been around for a while. You get five people in a room together. Would you agree that on occasion they're going to disagree?
Absolutely, Your Honor. But I think with respect to this specific issue, there may be some selection bias, or rather survivor bias. If the board disagrees with a referee's decision, the board certainly can and does either reverse that decision,
No,
award
I'm not
benefits
talking
with.
about disagreeing with the referee's decision. I'm talking about the board members disagreeing with each other. Because remember, two members of the board are from the labor organization class, two members are from the employer class, and one is from neither. And I just know you get a couple people in a room together, on occasion they're going to disagree. And these folks have apparently never disagreed. And my question to you is simply, how can that be?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, and I also, with great respect, I don't know whether the factual predicate of Your Honor's question is accurate. What I do know, Your Honor, is that in
Oh,
this
but he's
specific.
raised it, right? Mr. Goodman has raised it. This is not something that, the general public is aware of. How is this issue ever to be raised?
With great respect, I suggest that Springfield might be a better forum to the extent there are concerns about the institutional structure of the board itself or of how the department adjudicates claims. But what I can tell you,
Do you know how many decisions the board makes every year?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, and I also don't know how that breaks down between decisions that uphold benefits versus decisions that reverse benefits versus ones that end up getting to court
Let
one
me
way or
ask
the
a
other.
different question. Do you dispute on your that the full board does not meet together? Have you known of any instance with regard to deciding a case that the full board has met, whether in person or by Zoom, have five people get together? Does that ever happen?
I don't know the answer to Your Honor's question either way, but what I can advise the court, and we referenced this in our briefs, I apologize that I don't have the citation off the top of my head, is that in matters of administrative procedure, administrative agencies are presumed to act in conformity with the law. Again, I
Right. So,
certainly.
Mr.
That's not my
Noel,
question.
here's the problem
That's.
I'm having with the argument. I understand that the board has decided hundreds of thousands of cases in its history. I'm not aware, and nor is there any institutional memory in the circuit court of there ever being a dissent. And I think the only explanation for that is, as a statistician might tell you, is that it's because only a single member is deciding the cases and the others are just rubber stamping. I mean, do you dispute that?
I do, Your Honor, and
What basis do you have to dispute it? You're representing to me that in every case, including the three that are before us, the Salinas, the Liquidyn, and the Sony case, you're representing to this court that all five members, or it may be four, because I think There was a four-member board in each of these cases. Perhaps there was a vacancy. You're representing to this court that all four members of the board considered the merits of these appeals, and all five members ruled as they did on the merits.
Thank you for the clarification. No, I cannot make that representation because that information is simply
not in
the
record. Isn't that a problem? Because if the board, if each member of the board's
I think he's frozen.
He's frozen, yeah.
Oh.
Are the three of you actually in the building? Maybe someone can go to the room.
Oh, he's unfrozen.
I think he's unfrozen. Justice Taylor, you
yes.
broke off. If you could repeat those last few sentences.
Thank you. Of course, I lost my train of thought. So, but... you know, what I'm trying to get at is I think in each of these cases, there's four members of the board. It may be that there was not a fifth member because there's a vacancy. Maybe there's a recusal. I don't know. But four members of the board signed the decision. Wouldn't that tell a reasonable person that that person considered the merits of the appeal and decided the decision, the case on the merits?
I agree with that proposition, Your Honor.
But you can't represent to us that that's in fact what actually happened here.
No, Your Honor, because that information is not in the
Is that correct? Is that correct?
I'm sorry?
You can't represent to us that that's what actually happened here, that all four members of the board considered the merits of the appeal. Is that correct?
Correct. I can't make a representation either way on that issue because that information is not in the administrative record. What I can represent to the court
well,
is
we're
the
asking
legal...
about procedural. This is, it may not be in the record, but we're asking about process. Can you answer the question about process?
No, Your Honor.
We're asking, we know it's not in the record, okay? But we're, and this is something that counsel raised in their brief, right? And you haven't responded to it here or in your brief head on. So if you don't hit it head on, then what are we to believe?
With respect, Your Honor, I would dispute the proposition that counsel raised this in the brief. I don't think that a single citation to a newspaper article makes an argument. That being said, I
well, that's your that's your view, but it does raise an issue about procedure. And it was more than just a single line. I think there was a couple of references. So, but in any event, we're interested in the procedure here. So I understand it's not in the record, but we need to understand the process. And that's where these questions have to do with. Can you run us through the process? How does a case comes in? What is the process today with regard to the Board of Review?
I do not know the process with respect to how the Board of Review receives and adjudicates cases. I could certainly guess, but Your Honor doesn't want speculation. I'm not in a position to be able to make those representations either way.
But there is somebody who knows it, I assume.
Yes, Your Honor, my client would. This was not an area of extensive preparation in advance of today, and for that inadequacy, I do apologize.
Okay, thank you.
I would close by noting that in terms of procedural mechanisms, to the extent that plaintiffs in these or any of the other cases wanted either the referees or the board to consider facts in other cases, there were mechanisms available for them to be able to do that, either by calling witnesses in other cases. There's also a consolidation procedure, both before referees and before the board, which would, if successful, have turned everything into a single proceeding. That didn't happen. And without that, both the board and this court are left analyzing each case based solely on the record in that individual case. And based on those individual records, the board made factual findings, which are not against the manifest weight of the evidence. I have greatly overstepped my time. I do apologize to the court for that. I will leave it at that.
You don't need to
apologize. Mr. Mull.
We caused it. You can't apologize when we're the ones asking the questions.
Okay, Mr. Goodman.
It's a bedrock principle of the law that similarly situated, and note I'm saying similarly situated, not identically situated, I'll get to the distinction in a moment, that similarly situated people should be treated the same. That insight underscores lots of things. Class actions, for example, the sentencing guidelines, but perhaps the most glaring or strongest way in which that idea is expressed in the law is through precedent. It's one of the, if not the most important reasoning underlying precedent that similarly situated people should be treated similarly or identically. And the distinction here between similar and identical stems from the elephant in the room, which Mr. Moe, in his, eloquent, very high quality presentation, doesn't even address. In fairness to him, he's the third assistant attorney general during the pendency of these appeals. Our firm was privileged to represent 30 of the 33 people in 30 cases. And I don't know if the other three people had cases or not. There were then seven supervisors and then one supervisor above the seven supervisors. So a total of 41 people. All 41 of those people were fired on the same day. And the reason why all 41 of those people were fired on the same day is set forth in Judge Curry's opinion below, because it applied to Mr. Soni, one of the three people below. And this reason challenges our preconceived notions about the way the world works, but that happens all from time to time. The reason why all 41 of these people were fired on the same day is because the employer, Fresenius Kabi, lost a contract to manufacture a generic chemotherapy drug called Abraxane, Abraxane. And why did Fresenius Kabi lose the contract to manufacture generic Abraxane? Because the Chinese, in other words, the mainland Chinese, the People's Republic of China, equivalent to the Food and Drug Administration, sent inspectors to Melrose Park, Illinois, to inspect the Fresenius Kabi facility. And in a sort of diametrically opposite thing of what popular culture and American perceptions about themselves would say, the Chinese government inspectors were appalled at the quality of the work being done by Fresenius Kabi in Melrose Park, Illinois, and they implemented an immediate ban on the importation into the People's Republic of China of this generic Abraxane, because they said that Fresenius Kabi's pharmaceutical manufacturing practices were so unsound that these pharmaceuticals pose a an immediate health threat to the people of the People's Republic of
Mr. Good,
China who are
Mr.
undertaking
Goodman, I think that we're getting a little off topic. Let's get back to what's the issue at hand.
that. That is part of the issue at
Okay,
hand.
so we had 41 people fired on the same day. We've read Judge Curry's decision. Let's move forward with your
Okay,
argument.
so it's pretextual. So Judge Curry could correctly conclude what the 29, what was concluded in 29 of the 30 cases, that firing all of these people, that they were fired, that there were concerns about the cleanliness, but that the cleanliness, the violating cleanliness rules have been part of the culture of the organization. The reason why Fresenius Kabi laid these people off was because it lost the Abraxane business, and these people had very little to do. Mr. Soni spent almost all of his time making Abraxane. Now, Mr. Salinas and Mr. Likodine were part of the other half of the organization, and they made other drugs. But you had 33 people, say half of them used to make the Abraxane. The Abraxane was pulled out from underneath them. That's what Judge Curry recognized. That's what many of the referees recognized. That
What
is.
about the argument that these three are not alike, and we have to look at what they knew, and the testimony and the cases was not the same, and that the treatment here is justified because of the record in each of these cases?
There's enough in the record of the Sony case, just cabined to the Sony case. There's enough in the record of the Salinas case, just cabined to the Likodine case, the Salinas case, and there's enough in the record of the Likodine case, just cabined in the Likodine case, to conclude, as Judge Duffy did in the Salinas and Licking cases, as Judge Curry did in the Sony cases, that the hearing officers, the hearing officers in those three cases and the board of review in those three cases erred. And there are several reasons why that's the case. The first is, as it was alluded to at length in Judge Taylor's question of Mr. Moe, that these decisions from these other referees and these other hearing officers and these other claims examiners are not controlling. It's not like a decision of the Illinois Supreme Court is binding on this court, or a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court is binding on the Illinois Supreme Court. It is precedent in the sense that it involves similar factual and legal issues. And as the panel has already noted to Mr. Moe, it was temporally impossible for us to have submitted these decisions to the hearing officers in these three cases, because these decisions either came out after the hearings in these three cases or were received after the hearings in these
Did
three
you
cases.
provide an explanation as to why you were filing them in each of, in these cases after the fact?
We weren't filing them after the fact, Your Honor. They were attached to our brief in the Board of Review as exhibits, in much the same way as if we were to cite a unpublished California decision or something to this court, we might
And are
have
you saying,
submitted.
Mr. Goodman, that in your brief you attached them and explained that these decisions found in favor of the claimants?
Correct. There is
Okay.
argument, and that is in the record on appeal in each of these three cases, and it was in the records, the record on appeal before Judge Duffy and Judge Curry in the three cases below it, because we presented the other claims examiner and hearing officer decisions to the Board of Review to show the score.
Well,
And
let me just stop you. You practice in this area. You have experience beyond these cases, correct? Or not?
occasionally,
Okay,
I
so
am
but
much
just on
more
this
a plaintiff
case.
contingent lawyer, but go ahead.
Yeah, all right. So on the, on these cases that you handle, Mr. Moe said that you should have explained why you attached these cases, and that the reason the board didn't take them is because consider them is because you didn't explain that. Can you address his response?
Sure, it's not precise or fair, and the briefs. This is the fourth level of appeal in an unemployment compensation appeal, and your honors have in the records in all three cases copies of the everything that was submitted to in the circuit court, and everything that was submitted to the Board of Review, and everything that was submitted to the ALJ. And we offered the Board of Review the decisions of the extant decisions of the other ALJs at the time we filed the Board of Review case briefs in those cases. And we offered the argument, the same argument that we offered in our briefs in this case, and the same argument that we offered in our briefs in the trial court, that the Board of Review ought to follow the quantitative weight and the reasoning reached of these various claims examiners and hearing officers. We quoted from some of the decisions, in text in the briefs. We attached photocopies or PDFs of the briefs, the decisions to our briefs. So, and it was crystal clear why we were doing this. We were doing this because we were invoking this as similarly situated people who ought to be treated the same. And we were also trying to show that it was 29 to 1, or 20 at the time, 26 to 3, or 25 to 4, or whatever. And it's better to be on the 25 than the 4. It's better to be on the 29 than the 1. But one of your honors asked about the cleaning. I'm burdened, of course, by how our office handled 30 of these cases, and I did not handle all 30 of them, but I handled a number of them. But I'm pretty sure there are references in the records on appeal in these three cases. If there are not, there are references in the record on appeal in many, many, many of the 30 that our office is involved in, where people said that the culture of the organization, over and over again, people said that the culture of the organization was that you did the cleaning when you had the time. So if there weren't drugs to make, you did the cleaning. And if there were drugs to make, you didn't do the cleaning. Moreover, of the seven supervisors, the testimony was in many of the 30 cases below, perhaps in these three cases, that of the seven supervisors, that four or five of them had themselves been lying pharmaceutical makers, had the job that the 33
But
people had.
what, don't we have to look at that case by case? These are three separate cases, okay? So if the lawyer, I'm not pointing, I'm just saying in any case, there can be two identical cases. In one, the lawyer dots the I's and crosses the T's. And in the other, he only dots the I's, or she doesn't cross the T's. Missed some key questions, a key witness, key document, whatever. Those cases aren't necessarily treated the same, are they, in your experience?
You are correct. Craft is part of the profession, and craft is sometimes affects the outcome. Accurate evidence can be suppressed for public policy reasons. There's a variety of circumstances under which craft can affect the outcome. But here, I am answering questions that were raised of Mr. Moe. I'm answering them on a gestalt basis across the, you asked Mr. Moe, do you know whether X? I happen to know. And I'm not positive as I sit here today whether I know from the Sony case or the Salinas case or the Licodene case or some pastiche of multiple cases that might include some but not all. It's possible that the record in the Sony case or the Salinas case or the Licodene case does not supply these answers, but I'm offering this information for the panel's edification, not because I
Mr.
believe.
Goodman, I want to move on to another question. We were asking Mr. Moe a number of questions regarding the process by which the board decides cases. And I'm wondering if you know the answer to any of those questions. Mr. Moe did not. Do you know the process by which the board decides cases?
Not really.
Fair enough. Are you aware of any dissent from the board,
None,
in the board
none.
decision?
I'm aware of your honor's thoughts from 10 years ago when you sat in tax and miscellaneous remedies and heard first level circuit court appeals, and that I found that through Mr. Cadner's article in the Daily South Times. I am not aware of whether the procedures described in the Daily South Times were accurate in 2015 or in 2022 or today. I've handled a handful of cases in the IDES ALJ cases from time to time, but I do not have any in-depth knowledge about the procedures. I think that whether Judge Taylor's advocacy or comments, as reflected in the Daily South Town article 9 years ago, were accurate or are accurate today, whether the court is correct in whether I in adopting or sharing my inference that the Board of Review may in some ways be a farce or may not comport with procedural due process, those are interesting questions, and I think Mr. Moe is incorrect to say that they're properly addressed solely to Springfield. I think the court has the prerogative to opine on them in the foreground in an opinion if your honors believe it is appropriate. But it's not necessary to reach the question of whether the Board of Review's procedures are wholly unsound or were wholly
Your
unsound.
point is that we can rule simply on the merits of the appeal. We don't need to reach the
Correct,
process.
correct.
You mentioned procedural due process, which is not a term or phrase you use in your brief, but would you explain that?
Sure, I'm just using that as shorthand for the idea that's sometimes associated with the late Warren Court and the early Burger Court in the 1960s and 1970s of that before someone expressed in cases involving the family law cases involving auto repossessions, that before someone's property is to be taken from them, that they're entitled to a meaningful opportunity to be heard. That idea is also expressed in other U.S. Supreme Court cases from several decades earlier. Mullane, for example, the case that says notice by publication is heavily disfavored if you can give someone procedural due process. That a meaningful opportunity to be heard would include, if it's a multi-person panel, that each member of the panel perhaps participate in that. I don't know that there is a constitutional right to an appeal, but if the legislature or if administrative rules provide an appeal, that appeal has to be meaningful. And meaningful means that the arguments presented are confronting. And while the Board of Review is presently constituted may or may not be an outrage to one's sensibility, here, with regard to the three gentlemen whose unemployment compensation is at issue, I would respectfully suggest that Judge Duffy and Judge Curry got it right, that the Board of Review's decision on its face, the four corners of the Board of Review's decision, suggests that the Board of Review ignored the big picture. They ignored the precedent from the 10 or so other cases they were offered. They ignored in the Sony case the factual information, which a number of the other referees and hearing officers picked up on and discussed in their decisions, that the loss of work was the true reason for these dismissals. And they ignored the information which suffused the entire record in all three of these cases, as well as all these other decisions, which is that the true culture of this employer, unfortunately, was that cleaning was the lowest priority. And while there was a procedures manual on the shelf or on the internet somewhere that said you were supposed to clean, as a practical matter, if you were only working 8 hours or 10 hours or whatever your shift was, and there were drugs to be made, you were supposed to make the drugs and the cleaning was supposed to wait. And if the cleaning waited
Okay,
day
thank you,
after
Mr.
day,
Goodman. Your time is up. Do you have
okay.
any more questions from the panel?
I do have one question. Mr. Moe made the point to say the decisions that were attached to your brief, some of those were referee decisions, and he wasn't aware whether the employer appealed those or not. You have represented to a court that you have represented approximately 30 of these individuals.
Yeah.
Tell me the ones who received favorable outcomes, meaning the employees that you represented. Did they receive favorable outcomes at the ALJ referee stage and it stopped there? Or did they go on to the board where the board affirmed the or adopted the referee's decision and then it stopped there?
We were responsible for all of the decisions that we attached from the other ALJs. We handled, those were all successful appeals that we brought from claims examiner decisions where the claims examiner was reversed by the ALJ. The employer, Fresenius Kabi, did file a few appeals. They have filed a few appeals from cases we won at the claim. Typically, one does not have an attorney at the claims examiner level. But they filed a few appeals from cases that we or our clients won at the claims examiner level to the ALJs. We won all of those. And they filed a few appeals from the ALJ to the Board of Review. They sort of saw the score. I mean, I'm just speculating. Fresenius Kabi did not file an appearance. The lawyer's not here. They didn't file a brief. But as time went by and we were doing better and better in our batting average, Fresenius Kabi started doing less and less.
So, are you saying that many of those decisions of those 30 did not go to the Board of Review? Or did they go to the Board of Review and stop at that juncture and not get appealed to the Circuit Court? Help me understand.
I do not believe that there were any merits decisions in favor of employees at the Board of Review. To the extent that Fresenius Kabi brought second level appeals, I do not believe they were prosecuted to the point where the Board of Review issued a decision. They withdrew them, or they allowed a deadline to expire without filing a brief or perfecting the record or whatever they had to do.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Goodman. Any more questions? Okay, we'll turn back to you, Mr. Mill.
Thank you, Your Honor. With the court's permission, I would focus on the new arguments raised in plaintiff's argument. I'd certainly have plenty to say about the other portions, but I think the court has heard enough from me on that. To the question of pretext, that's affirmatively rebutted by the record. In each of these three cases, there was testimony that these employees' positions were filled. In the Salinas case, the employer rep testified the positions were all filled and the new employees were paid the same. That's at page 109. In the Ligodin case, the employer rep testified that 20 of the 33 positions had been filled because that hearing happened a little bit earlier and they were looking to fill them all. And in the Sony case, the employer's representative testified that they didn't actually close any positions. It's at page 118 in Sony, and pages 103 and 104 in the Ligodin case. To whatever extent a pretextual argument is properly before this court, because one was not presented below, the record affirmatively reflects that the terminated employees were replaced with other employees who were paid the same. So I'm not sure what benefit accrued to the employer because they had the same number of employees being paid the same before and after. To the procedural due process point the counsel made, I agree with Justice Taylor that those words don't appear in the briefing, and they actually don't appear anywhere below. It's well established that a procedural due process claim may be waived if not presented at the administrative level. And here, as far as I can tell from this record, no such claim was presented to the circuit court either. I certainly understand the concerns that counsel raised. In many ways, they mirror that of the court from the comments about half an hour ago. That being said, what the court has before it is cases that come before it solely on direct administrative review under the administrative review law. And on that point, the last thing that I would like to say is that I understand what counsel is saying, and I have no basis on which to say that his representations are inaccurate. But what I can say is respectfully, many of the things that counsel said are simply not reflected in the record. The proposition that employees were directed to clean when they can is absent from any of the administrative records here. The information as to representatives from the People's Republic of China is wholly absent from the record. A site visit to Melrose Park, that's nowhere to be seen. And ultimately, that's the
We're
problem.
aware of that, Mr. Mo. You don't need to dwell on that. We're aware of what's in the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just close with that. Each of these cases needs to be adjudicated based on the record in each individual case, as opposed to records in other cases. And based on those individual records, the board's decisions below should be reviewed against what was actually presented to the board, because that's the information the board used to make its decisions, and that's the information this court should review when affirming those decisions. Unless any of Your Honors have further questions, I would leave it at that.
Mr. Mo, you weren't able to answer many of our questions regarding the process by which the board decides cases, including whether each member of the board in these three cases actually reviewed the record and considered the merits of the appeal before signing their names to the decisions. Would you like an opportunity to file a supplemental brief, answering those questions?
I certainly can, Your Honor. Does the court want, would the court prefer that a supplemental submission address the procedural questions more broadly or what happened in this case in particular? Those might be different sets of
I
answers.
think both. My preference would be not only in this case, but generally, how does the board decide these appeals? What explains the lack of historical dissent, if in fact we're correct in that? Are there any instances of dissent in a board review decision? And if not, or regardless, does the board operate in a way, as reflected in that article, that is a decision of one, is a decision of all. So the answers to those kinds of questions and the other questions we asked would be helpful.
Understood. In that case, yes, Your Honor, I would appreciate such an opportunity.
Okay, 21 days enough?
Yes, Your Honor, 21 days. Thank you.
And then, Mr. Goodman, if you care to file anything in response to that, 14 days, okay?
Yes, I understood. Obviously, not knowing what it's going to say, or how, I may not take advantage of that opportunity. But thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Moe and Mr. Goodman, for your informed and thoughtful arguments. The case is submitted and we will decide it in due course.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.